Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, I Know It's Only Rock and Roll, But the Italians Like It, and it's about how music gives us a strong sense of place and puts us perhaps in multiple places. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows a little something about music and place. I'd call him a Pittsburgh guitar legend, but judging by his last album, his best days are still in front of him, Mr. Bill Toms.
Hello.
Hello. Say something for yourself, Mr. Tom, and introduce yourself to the lovely kids of radio world.
Radio land.
Or 99 cent earbud podcast land.
Well, I am from Pittsburgh. I've been playing music, being based in Pittsburgh for the last 35 years, I guess it has been, still just creating and trying to voice my, not only my opinions, but my vision of what I see around my world,
That's cool. So, as the 35 years, so I was 1 year old when you started. So, why haven't you realized that rock and roll is a young man's game and, just kind of grown up and bought some sensible shoes and a Chevrolet or something?
Who, me?
Yeah.
It's strange, I guess, because the people that came before me, they've kind of like, kind of cleared the path for, aging in rock and roll or music or whatever you want to say. But I think that, I look at it as more from a songwriter's point of view. Mm. And, as I got older, all those, you want to say all the stars from your eyes fell. And I kind of just, I realized that this is who I am, and you have to be truthful to what you do, and if you do that, I think that's where the best work comes from.
Absolutely.
And so that's where I'm at right now in my life.
Yeah, and I guess too, I remember reading, it was in the 90s, an interview in one of those like guitar magazines. Mm-hmm. I used to get those with Bob Mould, and he said about how, and they're like, oh, you've been in bands for 10 years now, and you're doing this thing, and where does it go? And he said, I always look, though, at, like, blues musicians who are in their 70s.
Right.
Who truly see guitar playing as a craft,
mm-hmm.
that it took them years to perfect and decades to perfect, and they're still doing it.
Sure.
And that's what I want to be, as opposed to, like, record labels or some fans that, like, if a guy can do hammer-ons, that's, that's perfect, you're good, that's what it is, and you got one trick or something.
Sure.
And so, you have this great record, Memphis, that I think...
Thank you.
It's great, and it's talking about a band that, like, hits its stride, and,
Yeah, I think that, the kind of music that I write, especially now, it might be a little bit different than what I was writing maybe 10 years ago. 15 years ago, but I think that the music that I'm really writing now just fits the guys that I play with,
mm-hmm.
and they understand that it's very I don't want to say traditional American, but there's just what I try to do is I try to reinvent what's already been there musically,
mm-hmm.
Through the history of American music, and that could mean rock and roll, blues, and is really what we do, but more like soul music, mm-hmm. rhythm and blues, and folk music and jazz, and it's just a great variety of grooves and there's just this canvas of so many different things of American music that I really enjoy. And I think what happened for me too is I got out of the pop end of things. Mm. When you're young, you're listening to pop music, it's just what's on the radio, it's what's out there. And even the blues guys that are famous, they throw that, this little pop to sell records, And I finally just said, it's just not what I like. It's not what I do. It's not what I want to hear. And once I was able to do that and just sort of like, you know, put that barrier up a little bit, and I listen to a lot of music, but I try not to judge it like that. But I mean, I really, really just like that old feeling of blues and rhythm and blues and soul music and gospel music. I love gospel music.
Yeah, and the band has such a lively sound.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much going on there for sort of the ear to enjoy, you know.
Right.
And I think that really comes through in the live shows, too.
Well, that's, you know, my thing is, you know, I could lose myself a little bit in the studio, but it's not something that I really enjoy that much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I consider myself more of a performer. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like to try to capture as much as I can when I do go into the studio. You know, as much as you possibly can. It's kind of hard sometimes, but as we try to get all together in a room and try to play it, you know, we're not really layering as much as other bands maybe do. I don't know, but
I was talking with a musician in another Pittsburgh band. They were saying how they, you know, the first record they recorded with like a click track,
right.
And then they said, no, we're going to set the mics up and we're going to be a band in a room and we want it to sound like human beings together,
right,
making a record, you know, or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah,
because technology has kind of, you know, can dilute mm-hmm. the realness of it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's easy for people to get sidetracked by that, and I try not to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's also a sense of the perfectionism that
right. Everybody wants to be hear the best.
You
know, I mean, especially as a musician, I mean, you or a songwriter, you want to hear the sounds have to be the best. And and I try to get away from that. I try to hear it as a whole, as real as I can, you know.
Yeah, and I think too also there's that, you know, when you're recording digitally, and of course we're doing this podcast mm-hmm. digitally, you know, like I just use Audacity, but I know people use like Pro Tools and stuff.
Sure.
And you can, you know, you can take a second and make it fill that whole screen,
right,
and go,
oh,
there's something wrong half as
right.
You know, the first podcast I did, I had to do an overdub and it was off by a second and a half. And I was like, I can't fail. I'll just put it up there. And then I asked people about it. Like, did you hear the overdub? Wasn't it? Because the piece I had to do was came in late. And they're like, you had to do overdub? Like, you know, which is, I mean, that's
you can overanalyze the whole thing. And when you start looking at those screens, you know, it's easy to think that everybody's hearing that.
Yeah.
You know, it's really easy to do that.
Yeah. And,
I can remember listening. A friend of mine had a tape years and years ago. He had a tape of a stereo version of Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's mono what was released.
Yeah.
But he had a stereo version which brought out keyboards, which I never even knew there was keyboards in that song, but there's keyboards in that song.
Yeah.
And it brought out the guitar, the main lick of the guitar. And he says, listen to this. And we played it through. And there's actually a couple places where the guitar skips a note, like literally like flubs a note, like Keith Richards playing dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
And he like slips off a note. But within the whole framework of the mono recording, you'd never hear it. But once you listen to it in stereo, all of a sudden you hear these things. If it's pointed out to you and you kind of go, wow, you know, and you know, they just played it in a room and they got the feel of it and said, this is it, man. You know? And so I try to, as much as I can, you know, I try to do that as much as I possibly can.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's a tough impulse. I mean,
it's very tough. You know, you're always thinking, oh man, we should just sit down here and, you know, fix all these little things and, you know, but.
Yeah.
I try to get away from that.
I think it was My Bloody Valentine. They worked on a record for 19 years. It's a great record. It finally came out last year.
It should be a great record.
19 years they were messing around.
I could never do that. I mean, I've read about, like, you know, even you know, the Beatles, take 39 or take 78. I mean, if I play a song more than two times in the studio, chances are it's not going to make it. You know, yeah. I'm just thinking that we just don't have it today. You know,
yeah.
We'll move on, you know.
Yeah, which I think then, I mean, leads to, I know music fans can be that way. There's that Beach Boys Smile box set where one disc is just every version of Good Vibrations that they recorded. All like 23. And it's like, you can hear the evolution of the song from this, you know, rockabilly thing to the when the theremin comes in. And it's like, wow, I don't need to spend money on that.
No, that's too over the top. And and again, like you said earlier, you go back to that, to what you really love about music. And the idea that you just pick up a guitar or sit behind a piano and just start playing. And I mean, you know, like the old blues guys, I mean, they would just, you know, just sit on the couch and somebody would put a microphone in front of them and that would be their record, you know?
Yeah.
I think Bob Dylan's first record took 4 hours to make, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just, to me, there's this, and if you go back and listen to it, it sounds and creates an atmosphere and a feeling that's no different now than it was then, I don't think. I mean, music is timeless if it's done right. Oh. You know, the problem with technology is you could date yourself real easy. I mean, listen to 80s pop music.
Yeah, I have a real hard time with 80s production stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it can really date the music, and that's, I don't want my music to be dated like that, even though it may be. I don't know.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of those things that just kind of happens. And, you know, to go back to something you said before about, you know, the blues gospel, which, you know, the gospel sounds, and I'm thinking about your live show and was listening to Memphis the past few days, you know, doing my homework for the podcast. And I was thinking about, like, some of the subject matters of some of your songs. You know, it's, you know, there's poverty, heartbreak, sin, salvation, you know, and it would be so easy for it to be this like dirge, but I think it might be humanly impossible not to have fun at a Bill Tom show. Like, right. I don't know how, I mean, the way that you just kind of fill the room, and I mean, even the banter between songs.
Well, you know what, I got to a point where you have to kind of, and I guess, just over the years of playing, I got to a point where there's so many things I want to do in an evening. You know, you're moving a lot of emotions. There's a lot of emotions that are going into it. And every show, every venue that you play has a different feel to it. So you're playing a different show or a different way of presenting it, you know. And I just learned to let my guard down a little bit. More, you know, I mean, I think, you know, off the stage, I'm a little bit more guarded and a little bit more introverted, probably a lot introverted. Yeah. But when I'm on the stage is the place I probably feel the most comfortable to let my guard down and to say what I feel, you know, which kind of makes my wife uncomfortable at times. She never knows what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
But that's...
Yeah, and so how does that work? Because you have this sort of other Bill Toms franchise, right? I mean, you go to Italy, and from Pittsburgh to Italy to touring the rest of the United States, you know, I think...
Well, I mean, I went to Italy, you know, I go to Italy quite a bit because I got a very good... promotional team there, and I've got a couple guys that I play with that we do band gigs. I got a bass player and a drummer there, so it's set up very nice for myself, and I worked very hard at it. I mean, it's not something that, you know, you just show up and people are going to come to the gigs. I mean, I've been, you know, when I quit the House Rockers, and we had played in Italy a couple times, I knew people, I knew like some songwriters. And so I just started going over and did a couple shows with them, you know, just acoustic shows and just, you know, in restaurants and just kind of like setting myself up and, you know, losing money and just going back. But I seen that in Europe, you know, and I would go to Spain. I did the same thing in Spain. And, last year I went to Germany and did some shows in Germany. And I think that, you know, as an older American artist, You know, the people in Europe, they see American music maybe with a little bit of different, maybe a little bit more exotic than people in America do. So yeah. there's a place for people like myself, you know, to go there. And again, in Italy, going back to Italy, yeah, we just kept every year, you know, until we got to a point where we were out doing big festivals the year before last and in the summertime. And I will be back there in 2015 to do festivals as well after the new record comes out. So, yeah, we just worked every, you know, you have to work at it, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's not like you're getting all kind of radio play. It's not like, you know, you have to build it from the ground up, you know, with the live shows.
Yeah. And so how does, like, your stage presence work when maybe not, I mean, you know, a lot of people in Europe speak English, but.
Well, I mean, English is is more common throughout Europe. I mean, Italy, not so much. And yeah, I mean, I realize that sometimes it's hard for me to tell stories. I mean, I try not to get involved in long stories, you know, things like that. But I think that just the energy or the emotion, you know, comes out. I mean, I don't really change what I do. You know, I may throw a couple lines in Italian out there, but you know, I mean, it's not. I don't really change what I do, other than try to speak a little slower and and maybe. But the passion, you know, I believe in what I do, and I just try to do it the way I would do it normally. And and I think people pick up on that if you're honest.
Yeah, you know, I think if you're honest, and again, I think it's if you know, there's that. I don't sound like a college professor in a minute, but because I am, that extra linguistic element of music where like just the groove comes through so strong.
Right.
And I've in the last couple of years started getting into world music a little bit.
Sure.
And I've played some, I was like, isn't this song awesome? This West African guitar, you know, look at the finger picking and it's so immaculate and whatever. And people were like, yeah, well, you know, and people couldn't get past that barrier. Well, what's he singing about or what she's singing about? I was like, it doesn't matter. The emotion is there. I can make a guess.
Right.
Now, the extreme case of that, or the bad case, in high school, though, I was into this Mexican death metal band called Brujeria. And their greatest song, they're the best Mexican death metal band in the world, I guess, if there's a scene or just one band. But they had this song called Matando Gueros. And I would, yeah, Matando Gueros. You know, it's just, it is their best, it's their greatest hit, if you can have a hit in Mexican death metal.
Yeah.
And about 15 years later, Beck came out with that record, Guero. And I was reading about it, and I was, oh, you know, Guero is the derogatory term for skinny white boy. And so I was like, oh, wait a minute. Gueros, what do Matando mean? It was kill white boys. I was Matando Gueros. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's still a great song, but I was like, oh, that's what it's about.
Okay. Yeah. You know? Actually, you got to be careful when it's in those situations.
But you know, it's like opera. You know, I hate opera in English.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Because you can understand all the words, right, but the, oh, like, you know, oh, that guy's pissed. You know? Yeah. It's just a way of kind of filling in that emotional, not technical, not exacting side of things.
Sure.
And that comes through.
Sure.
And so, yeah, so one of the things we were talking about before we got started, too, was this idea, you know, you're talking about you are making a new record. How does, you know, like, yeah, how the industry's changed? Because you were in a band that was on a major label, right?
A lot of very good independent labels as well, yes.
And, like, how this model now of, you know, because in a way, too, you know, when I heard you talking about earlier in the podcast about how, you know, just to have a feeling and just do it and whatever, and maybe not caring if it's popular or not, I mean, we do live in this era where recorded music has almost no monetary value. Or, like a friend of mine said, you know, you can spend $30,000 on gear and making a record that somebody listens to for, you know, they download it for 99 cents and through earbuds you hear in the dollar store.
Right.
And how that's kind of changed while you've been doing it. And you could just, you know, get one of these fancy microphones I got and Yeah, bust
I mean,
out
and
demos
people do that, but
yeah.
I try to. I think that, and you're right. You're right. And there's a big movement now of trying to make the sound. I mean, Neil Young has a copyright on a software, I think, that is making, you know, how we listen to music differently as far as, changing, like iTunes compresses music to make it smaller, to be able to hear everything. And you know, there's a big movement about how to create a more analog sound with a small, you know, MP3s or whatever.
Yeah.
And I try not to even think about, I don't even know what the, cause I'm not a technical wizard and all that. I still put on, I got up this morning, it's Saturday, and I put on albums, vinyl.
Yeah, me too. I still buy records.
Yeah,
you know?
Me too. So I don't know what, I really don't know what to do about this. So I always look at it through the eyes of a songwriter. You know, my thing is, you know, you have to write. It's like writing poetry or writing novels. I mean, you have to be able to believe in your ability to throw your ideas out there. You know, I always go back and think of Bob Dylan. I mean, you want to talk about a great songwriter, you know, as far as a great lyricist, obviously, but his records never sounded good. I mean, he even said that. You know, I read that in a thing where he said, "Well, my records never sounded that great because they didn't spend a lot of time producing." You know, and so I think about that. I think that, you know, as long to me, I'm a songwriter, and I got to get the songs out. I mean, I want them to sound good, and I want people to be able to enjoy listening to it. But that's not my purpose, I don't think. I mean, when I put out a record, I'm writing, you know, I write maybe through 3 months, through 6 months, through a year of music, and I'll go back and I'll start putting together things, and I'll see my life and how it was working in that 1 year, and that's my record. That's my vision of my record, where I was mentally, emotionally, you know, physically, you know, where I was for that 6 months or a year, whenever I was writing that group of songs. And that to me is a record. I mean, just to throw out one song, like you said, you buy for nine, and people buy for 99 cents, and that's not where my mind is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I always think, you know, I have this theory, this kind of theory of how culture works, and I call it the Bud Light theory. And
I this is going.
Okay, yeah. I think Bud Light is the beer for people who don't really like beer. Or is it maybe Miller Light? Miller Light, actually. I'll insult Miller Light. It's the beer for people who don't actually like beer. And that's there for them. And I think sometimes maybe iTunes is music for people who really don't like music. And there's still going to be people like me, the freaks, the geeks, the obsessives.
Right.
You know, we're sitting in my living room, I think, has my hot 400 albums that I just need to have. You know, I got back stacks up in the attic in my office.
Right.
For, you know, the repertory stuff.
Again,
but what I need right now, and
again, and you're right when you say that, because you think about the hit makers. Who are the hit makers play, you know, who's making them hit records is the people that really... To them, music is just background noise when they're doing the dishes, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, running the sweeper, you got, you know, something on. You know,
yeah.
Or in a club, and there's the, you know, dance music, whatever. But I think that people like yourself, those are the people that I'm trying to reach. Or, you know, and I shouldn't even say that, but I think that that's who I relate to. The people that hear music a little differently, that music will actually transform them somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember as a kid hearing, one of the first 45s I ever had in my life, I can remember was Penny Lane. 1966 by the Beatles. And I can remember listening to that 45. And, there, you know, of course, the big British invasion at the time had come. And I was just a little kid. And I can remember putting it on the record player. And in my mind, it almost created an English environment.
Yeah.
I could actually envision myself in England. I didn't know anything about England, but I knew how, you know, the people had talked with a cool accent. But that initial experience was able to transform me to someplace else in my mind. And has done that all my life in music. And I'm sure it does that to you as well.
Yeah. So there's this, strong sense that I think of Pittsburgh when I listen to your music or when I'm at your shows. So Memphis. Can we talk about Memphis then,
sure,
too? We'll talk about Pittsburgh some more. We're in Pittsburgh, but let's be exotic a little for me. I've never been to Memphis, but why Memphis?
It's really, it's really not about Memphis. The album is not about Memphis.
Yeah.
Actually, I didn't come up with the title of the album until it was almost ready to go to pressing. I needed a name for it. And I think what it represents is I wrote these songs at a certain period, and they were very American grooves, the New Orleans grooves, Bo Diddley grooves, and you could hear the soul and the gospel, and that's what I was writing. But the lyrics, all these characters had a Southern bend to them. And I didn't realize that until after I went back and listened to it, and I was thinking about it. And all these characters have some connection to the South, American South. And, I was listening to, there's a song called Waiting on the Pain, and it's really about a Civil War soldier who dies in battle in the South. Mm. And, then Memphis, Won't Go to Memphis, it's just a fun song.
Yeah, song about murder, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Eventually being murdered, yeah.
And, and of course all these other tracks, On the Road of Freedom is really about, I want to say slavery, but you can also say being confined to something. I mean, slavery, taken back in the history of it and standing up for it and dying for it, I mean, it's really about that kind of thing. Martin Luther King, who was killed in Memphis.
Yeah.
So those things kind of connect. Yeah. And so I was sitting on my couch and thinking about it, and I had all these crazy ideas of what I wanted to call the record. I wanted to call it, American Grooves or American, something. And I just said Memphis.
Yeah.
That's where that's the capital of the musical South. Soul capital of the world, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
And it ends, too, with that triumphant Let's Make a Better World.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is...
Which is an Earl King song, a very New Orleans thing.
Yeah.
And, which Dr. John put on a record many, many years ago. But I learned the song by hearing a compilation of a record a friend of mine produced for Katrina. It was a record for Katrina, and the Subdudes recorded that song.
Oh.
And I heard the Subdudes doing it. I go, man, I gotta play that song.
So when you you say about how almost then a record is almost like a journal or a diary, or
exactly.
And you do songwriter clinics. So how do you kind of teach people to get to that place where they could create these kind of little snapshots, vignettes, whatever, of a period of their life?
It's hard to teach. I mean, you're a teacher, and it's hard to teach somebody to break the walls down. You have to be, as a writer, you have to be very aware of everything that goes on around you. So you have to break all these things down and be very open.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to teach, but I try to, if I do a workshop, I try to tell people, you know, start by writing something, you know, that you know, and using all your senses, you mm-hmm. want to think about, you know, what it feels like, what it looks like, what you're hearing, what you're tasting, what you're smelling. You know, if you can start that way,
yeah,
about what that moment is. And I write snapshots. I write moments. I don't write a whole lot of narratives.
Mm.
Some, but not a lot. And most of my songs are written about a moment, and then I expand on that moment.
That's cool. So that's how kind of you're saying about how you're more uninhibited on stage. I mean, that is kind of also a risky thing in a way, too. I mean, if you can, you know, kind of just, you know, I think some people go through life kind of being numb,
right.
You know, or just, you know, not aware, not thinking.
Right.
You know, I remember, you know, being a college professor, I remember reading this article in the Chronicle of Higher Ed about, you know, the Obama plan to, there was a GM factory that closed, and they, you know, part of the people got buyout deals. You could either go to Lordstown, Ohio and make cruises, you know, mm-hmm. sell your house, take a lump sum of cash, or get a free associate's degree. And they were saying how, you know, this is a matter of national policy, and only a handful of people took the free associate's degree, and some of them had really struggled, and a lot of people weren't successful. And
right. There's
and it haunted me forever, and it changed the way I approach teaching. Was one person who'd made it through said, you know, you got to realize, you know, so you work at a job or you do this thing for, you know, sometimes 30 years where. Mm-hmm. Thinking and feeling is something you teach yourself not to do because it's painful.
Mm.
And you suddenly drop somebody in this environment where, no, you now have to be aware and think about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Is, and I thought about that, and I thought about, you know, sometimes the lives of my students and how maybe thinking and feeling for them might be something you almost like learn not to do because it is a scary world out there.
Sure.
Or people have situations, and I think about, I don't know, my own emotional well-being
right.
sometimes. And, you know, my job is to read stuff and feel it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, that's sometimes hard.
Yeah. It's very hard. But I think, for me, I can write about it easier than I can I don't want to say live it, but I can write about things sometimes easier than I can to look at them.
Mm.
You know, you know, if I see something and I understand the painfulness of it, you know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, we talk about the, you know, racial problems that this country is still exists. It's easier for me to write about it than to watch a video of, you know, white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I can feel that so deeply, but when I write about it, it's almost a relief.
Mm-hmm.
Or a release, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, if that makes any sense, I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. No, there's this French.
I mean, I can almost, like, when I see something on television or something, I sometimes I'll just get up and leave. I can't even take looking at it.
Yeah.
You know, but if I read it or write about it,
mm.
it's easier for me to, to deal with it.
Yeah, well, I think there's this French psychoanalyst who calls, you know, named Jacques Lacan. And his whole thing is you put it, through writing about it, you put it in some sort of symbolic order.
Yeah.
And so I had...
That's a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I had this thing happen to me last week where something was going on at work and it kept me up at night. And so I got up at 5:30, I think, on a Saturday and typed a friend, a colleague, this long email to just like, and this is why this is so messed up and oh no, oh no, oh no. And then... I was able to hit send. I was like, I'm going back to bed. It's 6:30 now. It took me an hour to do this.
Right.
But my mind was at peace. It's like, I can sleep for another couple hours.
Yeah.
It's Saturday, yeah. You know, and just...
Yep. And I've done that many, many times with writing, you know, where you're just pacing and you're pacing and then you sit down and write it and then you can relax.
Yeah.
It's a release, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of writing, so you're working on, now last time I saw you, you had a couple, at least one new song. So mm-hmm. new record coming,
new
happening.
Record. Yeah. We're going to start recording in June, actually. We're going to do Awesome. Started recording in the summertime, and with Will Kimbrough, who's going to produce this one again. And hopefully be out by the end of the year, or as much as we can, fast as we can get it, I guess.
Yes, fast. Well, it's all about speed nowadays. Just put that on the SoundCloud and get it out there. And, you know, I think I tweeted once. I think it was one of the first times I saw you. I think it was over at the old Frankie's over in Squirrel Hill. And I said, you know, every they should, like, clone this guy. They should make Bill Tom's bots. You know, it's like put him in every bar in America, and you could just kind of wheel him out, and then just everybody'd have a good time. And so I was thinking about, like, how do I get that in the podcast? Because I think it's a fun, fun idea. But then I was thinking, well, if there were Bill Tom's robots in every bar, eventually it would be like Terminator, where it'd be like Skynet, where they become self-aware and then want to, like, take over the world. So. If you could predict our dystopian future for a minute, like if the Bill Tom's bots took over the world, what would they demand from humanity?
Ooh.
What would be the first demand? Like, we are Bill Tom's. We have come to destroy humans. Or something, you know, else.
Yeah, or well, if you just give me dark chocolate would be good.
We have come to the dark chocolate.
Yeah. And then I'm good. Yeah. After that, we're good.
And on that note, I think it's time for the bottom five. Five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. You ready?
I'm ready.
You're ready. All right. Question one. If reincarnation was real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be? Say, like, the Buddhists got it right, or is it the Hindus? They both, I think, got it right, and somehow you did something really wrong, like maybe God really likes 80s pop music and dance music, and so you had to go, like, sort of single-celled organism, or, you know, what illness would you be? Disease, germ?
Yeah, I'd just be a virus. I'd be the common cold.
The common cold.
Yeah, I'd be like everybody's pain in the ass. You know, I don't want to kill people. I just want to be their pain in the ass. I always said, even on stage, I'll say, like, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. always said, if you want things to change in the world, you got to agitate. And so I always said I'm a big agitator. So being a cold would be a good thing for me.
A little post nasal.
Oh, I'd agitate the shit out of people. Yeah,
would be good.
Yeah.
That'd be good. All right, question two. This is from the book of Surrealist Games, actually. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
Oh, man. I'd have to go day.
No more day?
No more day.
No more day. I'm with
you. I mean, I like... it drives my wife crazy, but I love gray days. I love being in Pittsburgh. Yeah. I love it because I write a whole... like, I can never write... I got kids that live in Florida, and I go to visit them, and it's just like takes all the creativeness out of my
Well, you know, it's funny you should say gray days in Pittsburgh. I have a theory about this.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you think when Pittsburgh was built, kind of the first swipe, the old, the great old architecture of Pittsburgh, you know, that was when we had how many steel mills? I mean, I remember reading something about how, you know, in the 50s, if you could see the moon at night, that meant there was trouble. Because the steel workers were on strike.
Right.
You know, and there was unrest in the city.
Yep.
And so I think architecturally, Pittsburgh was built with the thought of sunlight, no sunlight in mind. And so I think this city looks the best on gray days.
Oh,
it's like, you know, sunlight's not its friend. I mean, I love this town, but maybe bright, direct sunlight is maybe, you know, it's sort of like... Sunset Boulevard. You know, I'm ready for my close-up to the mill or something, you know?
That's good.
All right. Question three. It's not really a question, more a prompt or an imperative. Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory from your childhood.
Happy?
Happy but somewhat unremarkable. So it can't be like, we went to Disney World or, you know, that kind of stuff. But just one day something kind of cool happened that wasn't that special but kind of sticks with you.
Man, I think I got a lot of those. I don't know. I mean, I think that when I was very young, we lived in the city. We lived in the Knoxville section of Pittsburgh. And so we would always, like, in the summer, I just remember the summertime, we would always just there would be like days and days of just ongoing baseball and kickball and ball, playing ball on the cobblestone streets, you know, and just in the evening with the ice ball man would come and we'd just sit on the curb and, you know, after playing all day. I mean, I just remember that. Now I know there was a lot more bullshit that went on, you know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. but
to me, when I was really, really young and living there, I mean, that's my take on that, you know.
Yeah. Okay, question four. What's one pop culture text or personal preference or just something that you wish people did or knew more about? Like, there's a music, a book you wish people had read, more people would read, an album you wish more people had heard about. Something that you look at and say, this should be more popular than it is.
Oh, man. Probably live music is one. I mean, yeah. I think we live in an age now where I don't think people understand, you know, that whole idea of going out to see a band. You know, I don't think they get it a whole lot anymore, you know. But I think that there's a lot of you know, artists that, I mean, obviously they just get, you know, painfully pushed aside.
Yeah.
And but I mean, I don't know, I can't narrow it down to one. So many, you know.
Yeah. Which you're right about people getting pushed aside or not getting supported or just, you know, getting, I don't know, just the struggle or whatever. You know, it's weird because I think, you know, Canada has that, like, sort of national endowment for the humanities and for music. And
right.
Now I'm buying a lot of really cool records from Canadian bands, and they'll have that seal on it.
Yeah, right.
The Canadian's going to take over American rock and roll because, you know, those people can afford to be artists or afford to live and play music.
The same as it is in Europe, too. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the festivals and a lot of the things are being paid by the state. You know, I mean, the governments spend money on the arts.
Yeah. All right, you're almost through the woods here. Question five. It's the last one. Yes, this is it. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? Anything from history that you think the world would be better off if it never existed? Some invention, some piece of technology.
Oh, man. That's a hard question because I think that, you know, you could say, well, I don't know. The cell phone, you could say that because sometimes it's irritating, but I think it's easier to deal with life with a cell phone than it is without. Yes. But I'm not sure of that one. I think that you know what? I think the biggest thing that I see is, and I don't even know if this works into that question, but in America, and I think that this is just America, because I travel a little bit, and I see people will have a tendency to break down the past. You know, we're always trying to update everything.
We don't
spend enough time thinking about the history of what we are and whether it's, you know, whether it's architectural or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You know, I just think we don't hang on to the past.
No, that makes sense. Yeah,
learn from it somehow, you know.
Yeah, hang on, learn from.
Yeah.
Don't recreate. No, that's
probably not anything to do with your question.
No, but no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's for me, you know, I didn't grow up here. I think that's one of the things that's so great about Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and that I notice now. Sometimes when I leave Pittsburgh, I feel like I'm in another country. You know, I've only been here since 2000,
right?
But I go places. You know, my parents live in my mom now. My father passed away, but she lives in a gated golf community in Myrtle Beach.
Mm.
And when I go down and visit, I feel like I'm in another country. Like, I was like, right. Well, what is this?
Yeah.
And I realized that that's what normal is. You know, these sort of
sterile.
Box stores, right. Sterile. Yeah. Everything looks like it came from Big Lots or something,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what is this? But then I can go back to my, you know, 19th century house and
right.
in the city and,
right.
and all yeah. of that.
I mean, it really drives me crazy sometimes with that. But and I can also live without, like, what, Paul Reed Smith guitars or something like
that. Yeah. It's bad gear. Yeah. It's
yeah.
bad gear, yeah. Well, I think that's about it. Thank you so much for doing
well, thanks
this
for having me.
And you folks at home, you need to go see Bill Thompson. Now, do you have, like, sort of regular gigs in the city? I know you're at Excuses.
Yeah, we do regular gigs, sort of like residencies at Excuses. I mean, I got usually one Friday a month I do with the Groove Squad, the Southside Groove Squad, which is just me with a bunch of friends, and it's one Friday a month from 6 to 9, and mm-hmm. usually the last Friday of the month, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually the first Saturday from 9 to 12, my band, my regular band, Hard Rain, will play at Excuses. And then we have certain gigs that we play, but then in the summertime we'll do festivals, and I start traveling a little bit more, so...
Yeah, so check the website, which I will have a link to that when I post this. All right, our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, or at least the last 10 episodes are on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're Gonna Die on Facebook and Google+. I think we're still waiting for the first person that's not me to like our Google+ page, but I updated it anyway, because, you know, the spirit. And thanks to Brett Zorich, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.